Chapter 59. We were at the dairy. If you have, how can you keep away from me? I am the same woman, Angel, as you fell in love with. Yes, the very same, not the one you disliked but never saw. What was the past to me, as soon as I met you? It was a dead thing altogether. I became another woman, filled full of new life from you. How could I be a yearly one? Why do you not see this? Dear, if you would only be a little more conceited, and believe in yourself so far as to see that you were strong enough to work this change in me, you would perhaps be in a mind to come to me, your poor wife. How silly I was in my happiness, when I thought I could trust you always to love me. I ought to have known that such as that was not for poor me. But I am sick at heart, not only for old times, but for the present. Think how it do hurt my heart, not to see you ever. Ah, if I could only make your dear heart ache one little minute of each day as mine does every day and all day long, it might lead you to show pity to your poor lonely one. People still say that I am rather pretty. Angel, handsome is the word they use, since I wish to be truthful. Perhaps I am what they say. But I do not value my good looks. I only like to have them, because they belong to you, my dear, and that there may be at least one thing about me worth your having. So much have I felt this, that when I met with annoyance on account of the same I tied up my face in a bandage, as long as people would believe in it. Oh Angel, I tell you all this, not from vanity you will certainly know I do not, but only that you may come to me. If you really cannot come to me, will you let me come to you? I am, as I say, worried, pressed to do what I will not do. It cannot be that I shall yield one inch, yet I am in terror as to what an accident might lead to, and I so defenseless on account of my first error. I cannot say more about this, it makes me too miserable. But if I break down by falling into some fearful snare, my last state will be worse than my first. Oh God, I cannot think of it. Let me come at once, or at once come to me. I would be content, glad, to live with you as your servant, if I may not as your wife, so that I could only be near you, and get glimpses of you, and think of you as mine. The daylight has nothing to show me, since you are not here, and I don't like to see the rooks and starlings in the field, because I grieve and grieve to miss you who used to see them with me. I long for only one thing in heaven or earth, or under the earth, to meet you, my own dear. Come to me, and save me from what threatens me. Your faithful heartbroken, Tess, XLIX. The appeal duly found its way to the breakfast table of the quiet vicarage to the westward, in that valley where the air is so soft, and the soil so rich, that the effort of growth requires but superficial aid by comparison with the tillage at Flintcomb Ash, and where to test the human world seemed so different, though it was much the same. It was purely for security that S.E. had been requested by Angel to send her communications through his father, whom he kept pretty well informed of his changing addresses in the country he had gone to exploit for himself with a heavy heart. Now, said old Mr. Clare to his wife, when he had read the envelope, if Angel proposes leaving Rio for a visit home at the end of next month, as he told us that he hoped to do, I think this may hasten his plans, for I believe it to be from his wife. He breathed deeply at the thought of her, and the letter was redirected to be promptly sent on to Angel. Dear fellow, I hope he will get home safely, murmured Mrs. Clare. Oh, my dying day, I shall feel that he had been ill-used. You should have sent him to Cambridge in spite of his want of faith, and given him the same chance as the other boys had. He would have grown out of it under proper influence, and perhaps would have taken orders after all. Church or no church, it would have been fairer to him. This was the only wail with which Mrs. Clare ever disturbed her husband's peace in respect to their sons. And she did not vent this often, for she was as considerate as she was devout, and knew that his mind too was troubled by doubts as to his justice in this matter. Only too often had she heard him lying awake at night, stifling sighs for Angel with prayers. But the uncompromising evangelical did not even now hold that he would have been justified in giving his son, an unbeliever, the same academic advantages that he had given to the two others, when it was possible, if not probable, that those very advantages might have been used to decry the doctrines which he had made it his life's mission and desire to propagate, and the mission of his ordained sons likewise. To put with one hand a pedestal under the feet of the two faithful ones, and with the other to exalt the unfaithful by the same artificial means, he deemed to be alike inconsistent with his convictions, his position, and his hopes. Nevertheless, he loved his misnamed angel, and in secret mourned over his treatment of him as Abraham might have mourned over the doomed Isaac, while they went up the hill together. His silent self-generated regrets were far bitterer than the reproaches which his wife rendered audible. They blamed themselves for this unlucky marriage. If Angel had never been destined for a farmer, he would never have been thrown with agricultural girls. They did not distinctly know what had separated him and his wife, nor the date on which the separation had taken place. At first they had supposed it must be something of the nature of a serious aversion. But in his later letters he occasionally alluded to the intention of coming home to fetch her, from which expressions they hoped the division might not owe its origin to anything so hopelessly permanent as that. He had told them that she was with her relatives, and in their doubts they had decided not to intrude into a situation which they knew no way of bettering. The eyes for which Tessa's letter was intended were gazing at this time on a limitless expanse of country from the back of a mule which was bearing him from the interior of the South American continent towards the coast. His experiences of this strange land had been sad. The severe illness from which he had suffered shortly after his arrival had never wholly left him, and he had by degrees almost decided to relinquish his hope of farming here, though, as long as the bare possibility existed of his remaining, he kept this change of view a secret from his parents. The crowds of agricultural laborers who had come out to the country in his wake, dazzled by representations of easy independence, had suffered, died, and wasted away. He would see mothers from English farms trudging along with their infants in their arms. When the child would be stricken with fever and would die, the mother would pause to dig a hole in the loose earth with her bare hands, would bury the babe there with the same natural grave tools, shed one tear, and again trudge on. Angel's original intention had not been emigration to Brazil, but a northern or eastern farm in his own country. He had come to this place in a fit of desperation, the Brazil movement among the English agriculturists having by chance coincided with his desire to escape from his past existence. During this time of absence he had mentally aged a dozen years. What arrested him now, as of value in life, was less its beauty than its pathos. Having long discredited the old systems of mysticism, he now began to discredit the old appraisements of morality. He thought they wanted readjusting. Who was the moral man? Still more pertinently, who was the moral woman? The beauty or ugliness of a character lay not only in its achievements, but in its aims and impulses. Its true history lay not among things done, but among things willed. How, then, about Tess? Viewing her in these lights, a regret for his hasty judgment began to oppress him. Did he reject her eternally, or did he not? He could no longer say that he would always reject her, and not to say that was in spirit to accept her now. This growing fondness for her memory coincided in point of time with her residence at Flintcomb Ash, but it was before as he had felt herself at liberty to trouble him with a word about her circumstances or her feelings. He was greatly perplexed, and in his perplexity as to her motives in withholding intelligence he did not inquire. Thus her silence of docility was misinterpreted. How much it really said, if he had understood. That she adhered with literal exactness to orders which he had given and forgotten, that despite her natural fearlessness she asserted no rights, admitted his judgment to be in every respect the true one, and bent her head dumbly thereto. In the before-mentioned journey by mules through the interior of the country, another man rode beside him. Angel's companion was also an Englishman, bent on the same errand, though he came from another part of the island. They were both in a state of mental depression, and they spoke of home affairs. Confidence begat confidence. With that curious tendency evinced by men, more especially when in distant lands, to entrust to strangers details of their lives which they would on no account mention to friends, Angel admitted to this man as they rode along the sorrowful facts of his marriage. The stranger had sojourned in many more lands, and among many more peoples than Angel. To his cosmopolitan mind, such deviations from the social norm, so immense to domesticity, were no more than are the irregularities of vale and mountain chain to the whole terrestrial curve. He viewed the matter in quite a different light from Angel, thought that what Tess had been was of no importance beside what she would be, and plainly told Claire that he was wrong in coming away from her. The next day they were drenched in a thunderstorm. Angel's companion was struck down with fever, and died by the week's end. Claire waited a few hours to bury him, and then went on his way. The cursory remarks of the large-minded stranger, of whom he knew absolutely nothing beyond a commonplace name, were sublimed by his death, and influenced Claire more than all the reasoned ethics of the philosophers. His own parochialism made him ashamed by its contrast. His inconsistencies rushed upon him in a flood. He had persistently elevated Hellenic paganism at the expense of Christianity, yet in that civilization an illegal surrender was not certain disesteem. Surely then he might have regarded that abhorrence of the unintact state, which he had inherited with the creed of mysticism, as at least open to correction, when the result was due to treachery. A remorse struck into him. The words of his Hewitt, never quite stilled in his memory, came back to him. He had asked Is, if she loved him, and Is he had replied in the affirmative. Did she love him more than Tess did? No, Is he had replied. Tess would lay down her life for him, and she herself could do no more. He thought of Tess as Is he had appeared on the day of the wedding. How her eyes had lingered upon him. How as he had hung upon his words, as if they were a god's. And during the terrible evening over the hearth, when her simple soul uncovered itself to his, how pitiful her face had looked by the rays of the fire, in her inability to realize that his love and protection could possibly be withdrawn. Thus from being her critic he grew to be her advocate. Cynical things he had uttered to himself about her, but no man can be always a cynic and live. And he withdrew them. The mistake of expressing them had arisen from his allowing himself to be influenced by general principles to the disregard of the particular instance. But the reasoning is somewhat moldy. Lovers and husbands have gone over the ground before today. Claire had been harsh towards her, there is no doubt of it. Men are too often harsh with women they love or have loved, women with men. And yet these harshnesses are tenderness itself, when compared with the universal harshness out of which they grow, the harshness of the position towards the temperament, of the means towards the aims, of today towards yesterday, of hereafter towards today. The historic interest of her family, that masterful line of D'Urbervilles whom he had despised as a spent force, touched his sentiments now. Why had he not known the difference between the political value and the imaginative value of these things? In the latter aspect, her D'Urberville descent was a fact of great dimensions. Worthless to economics, it was a most useful ingredient to the dreamer, to the moralizer on declines and falls. It was a fact that would soon be forgotten, that bit of distinction in poor Tess's blood and name, and oblivion would fall upon her hereditary link with the marble monuments and leaded skeletons at Kingsmere. So does time ruthlessly destroy his own romances. In recalling her face again and again, he thought now that he could see there a flash of the dignity which must have graced her grand dames. And the vision sent that aura through his veins which he had formerly felt, and which left behind it a sense of sickness. the spider not inviolate past, what still abode in such a woman as Tess outvalued the freshness of her fellows? Was not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? So spoke love renascent, preparing the way for Tess's devoted outpouring, which was then just being forwarded to him by his father, though owing to his distance. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.